Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear about the hidden history of Tulsa. Steve Gerken is an Iowa native who's lived here for many years and has been researching the forgotten but interesting stories about his new hometown. His book of stories of racial divisions and reconciliation, of larger-than-life personalities and unusual moments in our city's history, is the focus of his book, Hidden History of Tulsa. It's published by the History Press. In it, he explores great personalities like Sam Avey, Harry Sinclair, and Spade Cooley, old landmarks like Standpipe Hill or Cedar Street, which is today 6th Street, notorious people and landmarks like gangster Alvin Karpus and Benno Hall, home of the Klan in Tulsa in the 1920s. Steve Gerken is a contributing editor at This Land Press. Some of these stories originally appeared in This Land Press. He also writes wine-related articles in the international wine and cuisine magazine Gastronome. He's a wine educator, a regional cuisine and wine lecturer, and French wine scholar. He'll be giving a lecture tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock at a free lecture at the Tulsa Historical Society and Museum at 2445 South Peoria. The lecture gets underway at 10 a.m., and there'll be a book signing afterwards. Steve Gerken joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Steve Gerken, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
This is a really nice little volume, and this sort of reflects the writing you've been doing for This Land Press. And as a native Iowan, you've come to Tulsa, and now you're sort of dealing in unique Tulsa stories. Give us that perspective of coming from somewhere else. What is attractive about this particular area as far as our stories and why you focused on this particularly?
It was really an accident starting to write for This Land Press as kind of a cub reporter. Mm-hmm. I started doing research and discovered some history I had no idea. I've lived here for 36 years, but many things were not talked about, like the race riot of 1921. Of course, was not a riot at all. It was more of a massacre. And as I got into that and other stories, it just piqued my interest, and I've become a research hound now on the hidden history of Tulsa.
Well, this book that's out, the first part of the book does focus on our racial history. And how did you begin learning about that? I mean, probably after you've been here a while, all of a sudden we started hearing about the Race Riot Commission, and all of a sudden the stories are out there. But still, there's a lot of mysteries surrounding that whole early racial period in Tulsa.
Indeed. The general story is known now. I mean, there's, for years, people complained that there's been no conversation about the race riots, been buried, and both blacks and whites really chose not to talk about it. But I learned about a clubhouse that the Tulsa Klan built in downtown Tulsa, just north of what's now Kane's Ballroom, was originally Tate Brady's car barn. And it was called Benno Hall. Actually, the founders called it Benno Hall because it was Tulsa Benevolent Association. They actually incorporated the Ku Klux Klan in Oklahoma, mm-hmm. making them officially corporation and Tulsa-based, and they began this hall. However, it became Benno Hall to the locals, as in Benno N***s, Benno Jews, Benno Catholics, and Benno Immigrants. That raises a person's interest, and you start finding out a lot about the Klan and the influence and things that happened from Benno Hall. In fact, Benno Hall was built a year after the race riot, towering above, if you will, the smoldering ashes and the tents. There were 2,000 people still living in the Greenwood area in sight of Benno Hall. It's a huge three-story white alabaster building that had an auditorium that could house 3,000 people from Benno Hall.
Wow.
They conducted parades around Greenwood. They set up burning crosses. The men's part was very big, of course, but there's also a women's auxiliary, Rich.
And
there was a junior Klan to, you know, get the young guys indoctrinated into the...
We have to remember the Klan was incredibly huge, not only here in Oklahoma and in Tulsa, but in all around the Midwest. In fact, you look at elections were swayed by whether the politician had the endorsement of the Klan throughout the Midwest, from your home state of Iowa to Missouri to Kansas, Nebraska, and into the South. This was a very powerful force, and it was you mentioned some of the people they were against. It was against this sort of, quote, non-American influences, unquote, of any sort of non-Protestant white stock.
It was all about white nationalism, and it was huge in Tulsa in the late teens and the 20s. In fact, it's easy to prove that the county and the city sheriffs of Tulsa were in the Klan, The district attorneys were in the commissioners.
I would suppose you couldn't get elected office without at least an endorsement or being a member at that point.
They would door-to-door canvass people, the Klan, and if they didn't feel like you were going to support their client, they made you put a little sign in your picture window indicating that, in fact, at this point, you were not supporting the Klan. It was like a red letter.
Wow. And so this hall, how long did it function as a Klan headquarters? For a couple decades or a decade or two? I mean, really the power of the Klan was broken by the late 20s.
Indeed.
At that particular time.
Indeed. In fact, that would be the time when the Klan left the building. It became a number of things. It was a skating rink, a dance hall.
It was a church at one point.
It was a church. It ended up being the Tulsa Evangelistic Temple. It was run by Steve Pringle. The most interesting thing to me about that was he was a very popular radio evangelist, and so he broadcast from there, and he had a tent meeting one time. He invited a young preacher from Enid, Oklahoma, and he joined him, and it was Oral Roberts' first tent meeting was in a tent alongside the former Beano Hall.
Imagine that.
Imagine. And they preached together for a while after that. But it's amazing, you know, from a Klan building to salvation, it's kind of a stretch.
Now, one of the other things you did was, and you followed up on the work of John Hope Franklin, trying to find the whereabouts of Dick Rowland. Dick Rowland was the guy who got onto the elevator in 1921. And we still don't know what happened, whether it was a bump, a jostle, whatever, but whatever happened, the race riot ensued. And of course, he disappeared after this episode. Right. And you tried to sort of track him down. You found the family plot, right?
Yes. I probably should seek counseling over this. one of the startling omissions of the race riot in 1921 was the post-massacre nonchalance regarding the scapegoat of the riot. He was a diamond in the rough, and he was Dick Rowland. He was 16 to 18 years old, depending on different accounts, but I believe he was 16. And the incident that started this was with a person he knew, Sarah Page. In fact, in the oral histories of Tulsa with Eddie Faye Gates, there are several accounts where, they were intimate friends.
Mm-hmm.
And this was not an attack at all. Yet when the race riot started, he was forgotten by everybody. And so where did he go? And the sheriff told Damie, his mother, that in fact at 8 o'clock that morning of the riot, he had secreted him out of Tulsa and taken him to Kansas City to stay in a home of friends of Sarah Page, the person that he allegedly assaulted with intent to rape. It really makes no sense, but there are people who subscribe to that notion.
Yeah, and you, as I mentioned, you found the family plot. Every member of the family is there but Dick. But there's this other name that pops up, James Jones. Was this an alias?
James Jones was his real name, and his mother was Damie Jones. She claims that he was not her son. That's a different story altogether, but she found him on a dusty road in Veneta, in fact, and took him in when he was about 8 years old. So James Jones, he took the name Rowland because he and his mother, Damie, lived with her parents, whose last name was Rowland. They lived at 505 East Archer, which is now the center field gate to Driller Stadium. So you can get your hot dogs and get a little history at the same time.
Right.
He likely... there were rumors he went to Oregon. There were rumors he was in Topeka, Kansas. We really don't know. Dave Rowland, his grandfather, was a forward-thinking man and bought a plot at Oaklawn Cemetery at 11th and Peoria. And in that plot are, of course, Dave, the grandfather, and Ollie, grandmother, their son Clarence, Clarence's daughter, as well as Damie and her husband, who is Mr. Ford, Clarence Ford. Within 10 yards of that plot is a concrete, rough concrete, very cheap-looking marker, badly stained by weather. And on it says, James Jones, in parentheses, 18 years old, 1921. That's what's in a book about tombstone inscriptions. In fact, there's a little bit more on the tombstone when you go to it. It shows, in fact, that this James Jones died in March, about 2 months before the riot. Yet, it raises real questions. If he were to be buried there for some reason, maybe people would change dates to make things be a little bit gray. We really don't know. To this day,
it's still a big mystery.
I would say he remains an enigma.
You also tell a story of reconciliation of a former Klan leader that lived at 71st and Lewis, and a preacher who they got together for some fiery battles, but eventually they became best of friends. Tell us this story.
Johnny Lee Clary was a professional wrestler and became very interested in the Klan. He didn't have a good family. He was seeking some sort of organization that would listen to him, that would endear him, and he found it in the Ku Klux Klan. He worked his way up to becoming the Grand Dragon, which is the head of the Klan in Oklahoma, but he really had his eyes set on the Imperial Wizard, and he became the Imperial Wizard at a fairly young age, and the Imperial Wizard runs the entire National Klan Brotherhood. He had an opportunity in the 80s to meet in a radio station in Oklahoma City with Reverend Wade Watts, preacher of the Jerusalem Baptist Church in McAllister. He thought, great, here's a chance for me to make this black guy look really bad. And he told all of his Klan friends, listen in, because I'm just going to roast this guy. What happened was Johnny Lee wound up just kind of spitting out Klan epithets. And Wade would say, Johnny Lee, I just love you. You know, God loves you. And he cited scripture, and Johnny Lee just got really frustrated and stomped out. And then he started stalking Wade, and he went one time he found he was in a restaurant in McAllister. He and some Klansmen rolled in, and Wade had ordered chicken. Mm-hmm. And he said, if you, whatever you do to that chicken is what we're going to do to you, Watts. And he said, well, he picked it up, and he gave it a kiss. So Reverend Watts kissed the chicken. The Klansmen went nuts, roaring, and Johnny Lee stomped out. As it turns out, in a longer story, and it's all in the book, by the way,
right? Yeah, right.
He, at 71st and Lewis, decided he would learn about the Bible. It was either kill himself. He had witnessed his father blowing his brains out with a .40 caliber gun as a youngster. So he considered that, and he picked up the gun, put it down. A ray of light came through the blinds, illuminating his Bible, and he chose the Bible instead of the gun. And he wound up preaching at Reverend Watts Church, and they traveled around the country doing tent shows, and now works for Jimmy Swaggart in Baton Rouge as a televangelist.
Wow, what an amazing story. This is one of the stories in Hidden History of Tulsa. It's not all about our racial history, but it has a lot of profiles of some really interesting people and interesting things about Tulsa. My guest today is Steve Gerken, a local writer and contributing editor at This Land Press. Hidden History of Tulsa, Tulsa Historical Society will present a lecture and book signing tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, let's talk about some of these other interesting incidents. You have a story about the USS Los Angeles flying over Tulsa. This is one of the iconic pictures of Tulsa. It's on your cover of this huge Hindenburg-looking dirigible flying next to the old 320 South Boston building and Phil Tower. But another great story was when the New York Giants, the New York football Giants, as Howard Cosell would say, mm-hmm. came to Osage County to play an exhibition against the Hominy Indians.
Right.
How did this happen? This sounds crazy made up, but it actually happened in, what, the 1920s?
In the 20s. This was 29 as well. Yeah. It was supposed to happen on Christmas Day, 1929. In Oklahoma at that time, there were American Legion ball was really big, baseball and football. So a lot of towns had their teams, Fairfax, Pawhuska, Hominy, and all, Stillwater, and they would play against each other. And betting, by the way, was generally pretty heavy. In the Osage area, there was a lot of new money with the oil. And people, four Osage decided they really wanted to have an all-native 100% Native football team. They put that together pretty easily and had great success. They played in 1929 this big game. Barnstorming was really prevalent with pro teams after their seasons were over. Yeah. They would travel the country, make a little extra money, and that sort of business. In 1929, the New York Giants won the World National Football League Championship.
Yeah, the NFL proper, I don't think, started till 33 the way we know it today, but it was still, there was an NFL, and it was a very different game. These guys were all part, I mean, they had day jobs off in the off season. This was not like anything like professional football today.
The all-native team called the Hominy Indians really made very little money at all. Sometimes they would just split the gate. But they were a very determined bunch, and they were a very proud bunch. And they loved playing together. They loved the fact that they were all native. It created just quite a bond. The Giants rolled into town in December thinking this was just going to be a walk in the park. They moved the game from Hominy, which is just really kind of a rough pasture, to the high school stadium in Pawhuska, which is now the site of the Osage Tribal Museum. So on top of a hill, several thousand people rolled in. The betting was very, very heavy. And it was a back-and-forth contest, in fact. An intercepted pass in the third quarter allowed the Hominy Indians to score and go ahead first. The embarrassed Giants tried hard, did score, missed an extra point, and in the end, the Indians were able to squeeze out another touchdown and won 13-6. And the crowd went wild, and the bettors paid off their bets.
What a great story. And it's in the book. The last part of the book is a series of personality profiles, and they range from people that are very familiar to Tulsa history, like Harry Sinclair, who, of course, was involved with Teapot Dome. Mm-hmm. Sam Avey, our local impresario that ran professional wrestling, and there's a great story about the burning of the Coliseum and things like that, but also some really interesting stories. You tell a story about Cedar Street. Now, we know Cherry Street on 15th Street. Where was Cedar Street?
Before the streets from Peoria, what we know now as Peoria, east, were annexed by the city. They were named for trees.
Cherry Street for 15th.
15th Street was Cherry Street. 6th Street was Cedar. And Cedar was a grand thoroughfare. It leads straight through downtown from West Tulsa through downtown and ends T-Bones right at the University of Tulsa. Mm-hmm. The interesting story for me in this is a man, Khalid Rahal from Lebanon. He lived in a small apartment in West Tulsa, and he would walk all the way down 6th Street to the University of Tulsa. He wanted to be an attorney. That didn't work out for him, but he walked by these buildings at just east of 6th Street in Peoria. And a couple of them really attracted his attention. One was a bar, not because it was a bar, but he just loved the building. And he built in his mind, someday I'm going to own these buildings. Someday I'm going to do this, and I'm going to help this area become rejuvenated. Well, he's not responsible for the Pearl District by himself. There are a lot of very committed people doing a wonderful job. But he has been there for a long time, and he has had visions. He's opened some restaurants, and they've closed. He's the eclipse. He is a personality deluxe and a true, genuine entrepreneur.
And he was like an urban pioneer at that, you know, really, because there was nothing going on 6th Street. Most of the buildings were moribund, deserted, and he was really trying to make a go of it. And what's really interesting is even though a lot of his ventures have come and gone, this area is finally starting to show, you know, life. I mean, you're seeing buildings being refurbished up and down 6th Street now.
Kay prevails. I had a chance to speak with him a couple of weeks ago in his home down there, and he has great plans, and he gets real excited about it. And we walked around, and he showed me things, and such a nice man. I took a picture of him, actually, which is in the book, in front of the eclipse, and it turned out pretty well. It may be a back cover of this land, actually. I'm going to write a bio for him, and that may actually be on it. And I went by his house 2 weeks ago to give him that picture, which I had framed for him, and it brought him to tears. He is very very considerate and an emotional man, and I appreciate his friendship.
There's another story you tell, which tells of our gangster history, because Tulsa did have has this gangster past, and it was the Karpus gang, and they were based right here in Tulsa. Alvin Karpus.
Right, we're staying on 6th Street with this story. 6th and Peoria was Central Park. Mm-hmm. It was huge, much bigger than it is today. And it was a breeding ground of criminal hopefuls. There were a lot of people that wound up at Alcatraz, but there was none creepier than Alvin Creepy Karpus. He was wanted in 14 states for murder, was arrested in New Orleans by J. Edgar Hoover, his only caller, by the way. And one of the things that interests me about that story is that when Creepy, he's named Creepy because he has a very sinister look, and his friends called him that, so he was fine with that. He walked out of a building in New Orleans, and he was surrounded immediately by 26 FBI agents, and two of them sprawled out on the hood with their Tommy guns pointed right at him. And when it was secure, when the bust was secured, J. Edgar Hoover came out of the shadows and came up to the window. And his goal was going to be that he was going to put the handcuffs on Karpus. Here's the problem. No handcuffs. So America's Most Wanted was handcuffed with a tie from one of the G-men. Because the G-men didn't think there'd be any live people to take away. They just thought they'd be shooting him up, and so they didn't bring handcuffs. So he was secured with the tie and taken to jail.
What's really interesting about Karpus was that a lot of where he did his work, quote unquote, was up in the upper Midwest, Chicago, Minnesota, Indiana, and then he would come back here to Tulsa.
It's true enough. He and the Barker gang, of course, they were big in Tulsa, lived in 4th and North Cincinnati, Ma Barker. And mm-hmm. Sometimes he hid out there. But he and Fred Barker established a great friendship when they were both in the Kansas State Prison. And that carried over. They robbed jewelry stores. But their big heist was a man by the name of Bremer in Minnesota. They extracted $200,000 in money. And that actually began the unraveling of the whole group.
And that was a kidnapping, right?
It was a kidnapping, yes.
And so that was very popular in the 1920s because kidnapping wasn't really a federal crime. So you would kidnap a guy, hold him ransom, give him back.
Yeah. Yeah, banks were getting harder to hold up. You know, railroads were a thing in the past. You got to expand.
Anyway, he tells the story of Alvin Karpus in the book Hidden History of Tulsa. My guest today is Steve Gerken, a local writer and contributing editor at This Land Press. You can hear more stories tomorrow morning. He'll be giving a lecture at the Tulsa Historical Society with a book signing tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Well, I want to finish with one story, and this is a really interesting story. I've heard this guy's music for a long time, but I'd never heard the story of Spade Cooley. Spade Cooley was very popular. It rivaled Bob Wills as far as popularity in Western swing. But Spade Cooley went away for a while for killing his wife.
He did. LMA. Spade Cooley, born in a small town in Western Oklahoma, learned to love music early on. His family moved to Oregon. They gave him violin lessons, and he got the bug. He decided California was where he needed to be, and he started playing swing music. Even had a head-to-head competition with Bob Wills on the Venice Pier to see who was going to be the king of Western swing. Well, Spade had been out there for a long time. He had a radio show, TV show. He was making incredible amounts of money, very popular. So the thousands of people that crowded onto the pier knew Spade Cooley, not so much Bob Wills. So the cheering and all went in favor of Spade. And from that point on, he considered himself the king of Western swing. Of course, we know that's not right. We know that's not right. He played more kind of orchestral swing, a lot different than Bob Wills. Yet he took to pills and booze and wound up, became very jealous of his wife. assumed she was having some affairs. Turns out she did. Turns out he killed her brutally in terms that I left out of the article. It was just too heinous. He had a heart attack history, and when he was judged guilty, instead of sending him to real dire places, he was sent to a little hospital in Vacaville, which is Napa Valley. So Spade Cooley winds up, after murdering his wife, in wine country. Holy cow. But he reformed himself. He made fiddles. He did little concerts for inmates. And one night, they arranged to have him play for some people, and he figured it was just more inmates. They gave him a suit which didn't fit. They threw him into a limo and drove him to Oakland. There was a lot of people at the auditorium, a lot of cars. He said, must be a wrestling event tonight. He went into a dressing room, put on his cowboy gear, walked out on stage, and he's performing for the Oakland Sheriff Association, a benefit. He played three songs. They went wild. He walked off the stage, talked to his friends, went into his dressing room, and died to a standing ovation.
Wow. What a great story. What an incredible story. And what you also, he was about to be paroled.
He was nearly, his time was nearly done, and no telling what he would have done. Probably play more music, but he had changed his life quite a bit. And become a Christian and was really into helping prisoners. So maybe that's what he would have done, but he never got that chance. And the Chill Wills came out with the second half, and he said, Podnas, not going to be a second half. All I can tell you is Spade's gone.
Wow.
And the band played, actually, Going Home.
Oh, interesting. Wow, what an amazing story. There's plenty of amazing stories in the hidden history of Tulsa. My guest today, Steve Gerken, includes profiles of people like Harry Sinclair, Sam Avey, the story of Standpipe Hill, Cedar Street, which is our 6th Street, Alvin Karpis, Spade Cooley, and the story of J.J. Conley, who has J.J.'s Burgers, who's that's sort of an interesting story in and of itself. We'll leave that for people to read the book. And we appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Been my pleasure, Rich. Thank you.
Steve Gerken is a local writer, a contributing editor at This Land Press, and the author of Hidden History of Tulsa, published by History Press. He'll be giving a free lecture and book signing tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. at the Tulsa Historical Society at 2445 South Peoria. More information at tulsahistory.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.